From KUNC, this is Colorado Edition. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. It's Tuesday, August 20th. Today on the show, a sculptor in Loveland is hoping to break the bronze ceiling with a work dedicated to the suffragette movement.
You know, they had to get this bill together and work on this legislation to get the 19th Amendment to happen. And we're sort of following in their footsteps, working through some of the same actions.
Plus, we'll dive deep into the recent standardized testing data to see where Colorado students stand. But first, mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio have revived interest in so-called red flag legislation.
These are also known as extreme risk protection orders, and these laws allow family members or law enforcement to petition a judge to temporarily remove guns from a person who's seen to be a risk to themselves or others.
And now there's new polling looking at how widely they are supported and opposed nationally from the American Public Media Research Lab and our partners at Guns in America. Arlie Patterson joins us now to talk through those results. Hi, Lee.
Hey there.
So before we get started, this data was collected right before the shootings in El Paso and Dayton. What does it show?
Well, before I hit you with a bunch of numbers, the survey basically says that there's a lot of support for these laws. 77% of Americans support family-initiated extreme risk protection orders. 70% support orders when they're initiated by law enforcement. Support is high among Democrats, Republicans, independents, and it's also fairly high among gun owners. 67% of gun owners support orders that are initiated by family members. 60% support them when they're initiated by police.
Do we know why there's such broad support?
I asked a couple of experts about that. One of them is Cassandra Crafassi. She is the deputy director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Gun Policy and Research in Baltimore, Maryland. First off, she says these orders are temporary. You're not removing someone's guns forever or even for an extended period of time necessarily. And then there's also this.
It's not focused on all gun owners. It's focused on gun owners who are exhibiting risky behaviors that I think we can reasonably agree. Someone who's posting online about committing a mass shooting or someone who's sharing with a family member or friend that they're thinking about harming themselves, that's someone that we would want to separate from firearms.
It's important to know, though, that around a quarter of respondents were opposed to extreme risk orders. These numbers are unsurprisingly higher among gun owners. People living in southern and western states also reported higher levels of opposition. And in western states, like Colorado in particular, opposition to orders initiated by police specifically was the highest at 35%.
Colorado lawmakers approved extreme risk protection legislation earlier this year, and that's going to take effect in January. What are some of the main points of opposition?
Well, as listeners might remember, the debate about this bill was fierce. Outside groups, both for and against gun control, were involved. Ultimately, the bill did pass, but just barely. And since then, there have been efforts to recall lawmakers who voted for it. There are several sheriffs who say that, listen, when this thing takes effect, we're not going to enforce it. And there's also an outstanding legal challenge against the law. I think all of these developments taken together boil down to a couple of main points of opposition that I'm going to go through. That extreme risk laws violate gun rights, that they violate due process, that they could be used in a malicious way, you know, thinking about a disgruntled neighbor or angry ex, for example, and that extreme risk laws don't directly address mental health concerns. I called up Amy Swearer at the Heritage Foundation to talk through some of this.
There are legitimate, I think, underlying fears. If these laws are not properly narrowed, that if they're not using specific enough language, that if they're not being couched in appropriate measures of due process, that it can open the door for a lot of abuse.
So we know public opinion doesn't always mean legislative action. Is there going to be any movement on this issue at the federal level?
President Trump has voiced support for these types of laws recently and also in 2018 after the shooting in Parkland, Florida. The legislative push now, though, is a bit unclear. Democrats don't want federal red flag or extreme risk order legislation to pass on its own unless it's coupled with stricter universal background checks, which is something else that has broad public support. The House Judiciary Committee has said it is planning to take up an extreme risk bill in early September.
That was our Guns in America reporter, Lee Patterson. Thanks, Lee.
You're welcome.
And you can find the complete survey on our website, kunc.org.
And And now a quick look at some of the news you might have missed.
Residents and businesses in Denver's Stapleton neighborhood have voted not to change the neighborhood's name. Some advocates had been calling for the name change, citing its namesake's historic association with the Ku Klux Klan. One of those groups, Rename Stapleton for All, said in a statement they were disappointed but not surprised by the results. They say the outcome of this vote, as well as a recent incident of racist graffiti in a neighborhood park, point to a real need in Denver to educate the public about the role of the KKK in Colorado politics. The results were 65% against the name change, 35% in favor, with about 34% turnout.
A new report out this month finds invasive insects and diseases are killing millions of trees each year in forests across the U.S. Randall Morin is with the U.S. Forest Service and a co-author of the study. He says this proliferation of invasive species impacts forests' natural ability to store carbon, which can help fight climate change.
And the invasive emerald ash borer appears to be on the move. Forestry officials say they have found the insect in trees in Broomfield. Tom Wells, a forester with the city and county, says it's the first confirmation outside of a federal quarantine in Boulder County.
You know, it's been slowly moving out of Boulder, through Boulder County. You know, it's been found in Superior and Lafayette, so it's around.
Wells says he's responding by removing public ash trees that are at risk of infestation and urging residents to get their own trees inspected. The highly destructive emerald ash borer has been in the state since 2013. Once it shows up in a tree, that tree usually dies within 2 to 4 years.
The Denver-based band Nathaniel Rateliff and the Night Sweats are launching a special edition cannabis collection. It's under Willie's Reserve, a cannabis brand owned by country legend Willie Nelson. It's going to be called the Night Stash Collection. Rateliff says he hopes to use the line in part as a way to advocate for the cannabis industry. He also wants to help those in prison for marijuana crimes.
And last week on Colorado Edition, we brought you the story of an undeveloped piece of land off Highway 36 in Louisville. As of last night, there have been some updates to the story. To learn about the latest, we're talking with Lucas High, a reporter for Biz West. Lucas, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So what happened in the meeting on Monday?
Well, I wish I could tell you that I have all the answers now, and, you know, Acme Widget Corporation is moving in, and they're going to hire 700 people by, you know, the next year. Unfortunately, we don't have that level of detail yet, but we do have something interesting. We have the project's name, which hadn't been unveiled until last night. So the developer, which is a Denver company called Brubockle Capital Partners, is calling the project Nahuatney Ridge. And the name is significant because it's a reference to Louis Nahuatney, who is the namesake of Louisville. He was one of the city's founding fathers in the late 1800s.
So what was the reaction from Louisville residents?
It was mixed. I think there are some folks that are excited, like any development. I think there are some folks that are concerned with issues like transportation and traffic and overcrowding and things like that. But there wasn't, as far as I could tell, a particularly negative reaction. So, I think folks are just kind of playing the kind of wait and see game until some more details about the project come out.
What does happen next, or do we know when any more details are forthcoming?
The way that the process works is plans for the project will go before Louisville's Planning Commission, which will offer a recommendation that will ultimately go ahead to the Louisville City Council to approve a couple of amendments that are required before any, you know, groundbreaking can actually take place. And the expectation is that the project will go before Planning Commission sometime in the next couple of months, and then likely before the City Council, probably sometime late 2019.
Lucas High is a reporter for Biz West. Thanks for the update.
Thanks so much.
This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.
Each year, the state releases standardized test score data. It's used for things like statewide accountability, legislation, and, of course, to provide a snapshot of where Colorado students are academically.
And each year, there's a ton of data to sift through, a task that's really too big for the two of us alone. To give us a big picture look at state test score data is Erica Melter, Bureau Chief at Chalkbeat Colorado. Erica, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So quickly, what was the data released last week?
The results that we're getting are from state tests that students took in the spring. This is the CMAS, or Colorado Measures of Academic Success test, that's given to third through eighth graders. And then in high school, students take the PSAT or the SAT. And these are significant because they give they give schools and districts a sense of how their students are doing, and they're also used for the state to establish ratings for schools and determine which schools might need extra attention or even intervention.
You took a look at the data. What are the big takeaways?
When we look statewide, we see that, once again, this is a result that we've seen for many years, that more than half of students are not reading or writing or doing math at grade level expectations. We have 45.8% of students met or exceeded the standards in literacy. That's up about 1.3 percentage points from last year. Math is 34.7% of students meeting or exceeding expectations, and that's almost the same as last year. These are not the results that officials would want to see. And even more concerning is that we have large disparities based on race and income that have remained essentially unchanged for the last number of years. They are seeing a few positive trend lines. For example, in literacy, they are seeing scores go up a little bit every year at every grade. And now with 5 years of data, they do think that is a positive trend line. And they're hopeful that additional investments in full-day kindergarten and early literacy will continue to move those numbers. Math is a much more mixed picture. You have students doing better in some grades, but in sixth grade math, we're actually down over a five-year period. And SAT scores went down a little bit this year as well. Overall, the picture is pretty flat.
I want to talk about those flat numbers. That's not necessarily a problem unique to Colorado, right? It's kind of a national problem.
That's correct. There's a national test called the NAEP. It's the National Assessment of Educational Progress. And those scores have been flat nationally for about a decade now. You see, any given year, they might go up a little here, up, down a little there. But we're just not making a lot of progress. And to be honest, people aren't entirely sure why.
Erica Meltzer is the bureau chief at Chalkbeat Colorado. Thanks for breaking it down for us.
No problem.
And now to get a picture of what this data looks like across some schools along the Front Range, we turn to our education reporter, Stephanie Daniel. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Erin.
Now, you've also been looking at this state test data, and in particular, you've looked at achievement gaps.
Right. And now, first, I just want to give some context. So when we talk about poverty, we are talking about students who qualify for free or reduced lunch. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the disparities in achievement. And then there's also race and ethnicities also show disparities. So when it comes to poverty, there was a disparity of about 30 percentage points across all grades that are persisting when it comes to looking at students who are on free or reduced lunch compared to students who are not. And then when we look at race and ethnicities, the state found smaller percentages of Black and Hispanic students met or exceeded expectations on these state tests compared to their white counterparts. For example, about 60% of white fifth graders met or exceeded expectations on the English language arts test, compared to only about 30% of Black and Hispanic students that reached this benchmark.
These are statewide numbers that we're talking about. Have you taken a look at any school districts along the Front Range to see what these gaps look like there?
Yes, I looked at Greeley-Evans School District 6, and about 68% of the student population is minority students, and actually about 90% of those then identify as Hispanic or Latino students. So the district is majority minority students, and about 62% fall into this poverty category. They qualify for free and reduced lunch. Now, the school district is following the state trends that we heard from Erica. If you look at, if you combine third through eighth graders and look at the English language arts test, the students are doing a little bit better, but in math, it's about the same. The district is also following the state trends as far as the achievement gap, and that is persistent. I spoke to Teresa Myers, who heads up communications for District 6, and this is what she had to say about the achievement gap.
The achievement gap is always an issue with us, not only with our students of color, but with our students who live in poverty. And there is a direct correlation, not just in District 6, but nationwide, between students who live with poverty and students who are affluent when you look at student achievement. So we know that that is work that we need to be doing.
Teresa Myers told me that the district has implemented co-teaching, and it's a method where they have their content teacher in the classroom as well as another teacher who can provide more instruction and help students, whether it's English language learners or special education students, to just help close that gap.
Let's talk about SAT scores. A record number of Colorado students took the SAT this year, but as Erica mentioned, scores went down.
And yeah, almost 58,000 or more than 92% of 11th grade students across the state took the SAT test, which is a record high for public school participation. And this is since 2001, when students are actually started taking the test during the school week as opposed to on the weekend. So this has affected the number of students which are taking the test, which makes sense. So I talked to a spokesperson from Boulder Valley School District, and they had a participation rate of about 88%, which was slightly lower than the state average, but their students' mean average test scores for both the reading and writing and the math tests were higher than the state average. And Randy Barber, who I spoke to, says, while it's encouraging for the district that so many students are taking the SAT, it just tells a part of their academic story.
It helps us to make sure that the students are well prepared for the university and the careers that they have after it. But we don't just stop at that, you know, regardless of which pathway they want to take. If they you know, potentially want to go into, you know, career tech ed, we have got programs for that as well. This is just a one piece of the puzzle, and we're glad that so many students do participate on an annual basis.
Like Randy Barber said, the SAT, as well as the PSAT and CMAS tests, are just part of a student's academic puzzle. And of course, they're very important for statewide accountability and to compare districts and schools and even students with each other. But it's just one piece of the puzzle.
Stephanie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Another big story in education this year is full-day kindergarten. We talked to Governor Jared Polis about full-day K. You can hear that interview on Thursday's episode of Colorado Edition. On August 18, 1920, the 19th Amendment was ratified, giving women throughout the United States the right to vote. And almost 100 years later, a Loveland sculptor says it's an event worth celebrating and commemorating. And she's hoping to convince some in Washington, D.C. of it, too. KUNC arts reporter Stacy Nick has more.
One of the biggest projects in artist Jane D. Decker's career is happening now, because of something that happened last year.
I was a finalist to do a piece in Central Park.
It was for the Monumental Women's Statue Project in New York City. It's the park's first historical sculpture depicting a woman. Artists were asked to submit designs for a monument honoring two pioneers of the suffragette movement, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. But as D. Decker researched Stanton and Anthony, she learned more about others crucial to the movement, like Sojourner Truth and Harriet Stanton Blatch.
I didn't win the competition, but my piece just grew and got a life of its own. I was so inspired by their work.
Eventually, six women were added to the design for her bronze sculpture, including Alice Paul and Ida B. Wells. Various versions of it can be found throughout her Loveland studio, including a very large clay model.
It barely fits here. It's will be 21 feet tall, and my ceiling's 18, so I'm having to sculpt it in sections. So I'll be climbing up and down the scaffolding for the next 10 months I have to try to get it sculpted.
That deadline, just in time for the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, is a self-imposed one, for now.
When she showed me this piece last year, I was so moved.
That's D. Decker's longtime friend, Jody Shattuck McNally.
When we realized it wasn't going to go to New York City Central Park, I said, Jane, this piece is meant to be somewhere prominent to help inspire future generations and also to teach this history. It's not taught or told on most of our history books.
And what's a more prominent and inspirational place than among the other historical monuments in Washington, D.C.?
We knocked down 97 out of 100 Senate doors, and we talked to anyone who would listen to tell about our project.
Including Colorado Senators Cory Gardner and Michael Bennett and Congressman Joe Neguse. They've introduced bills to get D. Decker's monument approved under the Commemorative Works Act.
We're kind of following their footsteps. You know, they had to get this bill together and work on this legislation to get the 19th Amendment to happen, and we're sort of following in their footsteps, working through some of the same actions, getting the legislative help and the good doors, you know, so we feel like it's sort of a little bit like their grassroots movement getting this to happen.
But there's a lot more to getting a public commemorative artwork approved than you might realize. There's meetings with the National Planning Commission and the Fine Arts Commission, as well as with engineers for the environmental and traffic studies that have to be done on proposed sites.
We're doing that work as we go along with the hopes that, fingers crossed, that we can be ready to go when be positive when the bill passes.
McNally and Dedecker also started the nonprofit group Every Word We Utter. Named after the sculpture, they hope to raise awareness for the project, along with the more than $1 million needed to complete the artwork.
I'm going to turn this way, so I'm going to...
After grinding down the plaster models, known as maquettes, Jane Dedecker shows me some of her larger models, or at least part of them.
We had to cast it in pieces, so this will be, we'll have to glue back on her head, and I have Susan, and I have the two women, and Harriet's there, and Sojourner's over there, and...
Some of these ladies didn't even get to see the fruits of their labor. Now for you, what happens if this does not get approved? So where do you go from there?
I think we'll find a place for it. I really feel like it needs to be in D.C. because they did change the Constitution and they stormed those halls and 41 times they went to introduce their bill and were denied.
Less than 10% of public art in the United States is dedicated to historical women. The National Park Service has more than 150 sculptures, and less than a handful commemorate women from American history. For Dedecker, that's not enough, because for her, it's about more than just honoring our past. It's about inspiring our future. It's kind of like a line from a letter Elizabeth Cady Stanton wrote in 1880, the one that inspired the name for the sculpture.
Every word we utter, every act we perform, waft to innumerable circles beyond. And she just felt like any movement that we do and the energy that we put into something, younger women and other people will feel.
Stacy Nick, KUNC, Loveland.
Erin, do you know what today is?
Tuesday. Last time I checked, it was Tuesday.
Yeah, it is Tuesday, but it's also National Radio Day.
Oh, hey.
Yeah, so we decided to go around the station and we talked to some of our colleagues about what radio means to them.
Hi, I'm Margo. You hear me middays on 105.5 The Colorado Sound. Today is National Radio Day. For me, that's every day. And I still can't believe that I get to wake up every day, go to work, and talk about history and play music and do that for a living. Radio DJs of my youth were my heroes, and it's an honor to be able to continue the tradition.
I'm Desmond O. Boyle, and I host All Things Considered for KUNC. Radio to me is the ability to tell a story or hear a song and then create an image in my mind. Radio has the power to change minds, inspire others, and act as a companion to someone who may need a friend. Sometimes we find ourselves alone, but when you turn on the radio, there is someone listening with you. There is someone there keeping you company. To me, radio is a friend.
Hey, everybody. I'm Danielle, Community Engagement Coordinator for the Colorado Sound and KUNC. I'm here to talk to you today about what radio means to me. I think that it's great that we have such a wonderful community public radio station here in Northern Colorado. Whether you listen to KUNC or the Colorado Sound, we're all about our community. Whether it's local news or local music, this is where you find out what is happening in our community. Thank you so much for your support of public radio, and happy National Radio Day.
Hi, it's Ron, the morning show host from the Colorado Sound, and for National Radio Day, answering the question, what does radio mean to me, is pretty simple, because as a teenager, I used to go home for lunch in my car just so I could listen to Tom Curtis, the midday host on WMAL-FM in Washington, D.C. And he was the guy that made me feel like I was connected to the world, that I was up on music, and I knew everything that was going on. He's the guy that made me want to go into radio. So what does radio mean to me? It really means everything. It kind of gave me my world for these past X number of years. Happy Radio Day, everyone.
I'm Stacy Nick, arts and culture reporter for KUNC. And growing up in rural Adams County, radio was just my connection to a much larger world, and it meant that I wasn't so isolated. It's how I knew I wasn't alone.
I'm Neil Best, CEO at KUNC in the Colorado Sound. I used to listen to Bob Martin and Pete Smyth on the old KOA. I used to listen to the fabulous Kim out of Denver, and at night, listen to KOMA, Oklahoma City. I've sung along with the radio. I've argued with the radio. I've learned from the radio. Radio has been my constant companion for 70 years. It's National Radio Day. Celebrate.
Okay, Aaron, so what does radio mean to you?
Oh, man, so much. I mean, radio has been an amazing career journey. I feel like I've been able to connect with so many people from so many different walks of life, people I really wouldn't have met otherwise. In college, I wrote a term paper on why radio is the most influential form of media. I'd be happy to read from that right now, if you would like.
Maybe in a future show.
A future show. Okay, great. Really, though, seriously, radio is just a way to tell stories using the power of sound. It harnesses your imagination when you're listening, and I love that. What about you? How do you feel about radio?
Well, I love it for a lot of the same reasons you said, and I get to visit places that I'm just unfortunately not going to get to travel to in my lifetime, and radio just has a way of taking you there that's, I don't know, it's just kind of gives me the fizz.
It's like an amazing passport to anywhere.
Yeah, it's the best.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow, we'll discuss the state's new zero-emission vehicle standards and what they mean for air quality in our region. Colorado Edition is hosted by me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Henry Zimmerman. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer. And we want to thank you for listening.
Remember, you can add us to your podcast feed on iTunes or wherever you subscribe so you never miss an episode.